Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What if centuries of werewolf lore got it wrong, so that these legendary creatures were not turned into savage animals by the light of the full moon, but remained fully human in their thoughts even as their bodies transformed into something vastly stronger, more sensitive to scent and sound than any mortal person? These are some of the questions that color the ongoing saga of Reuben Golding, the fictional hero of Anne Rice's new Wolf Gift Chronicles. The latest, which is the second book in the series, is called The Wolves of Midwinter, and it's out just in time for a little Halloween reading. Anne Rice is in town for an appearance this evening at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. Anne, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So the Wolf Gift Chronicles are set in Northern California, which is such a rich and romantic setting. To what extent does place really color the things you do with your characters?
Oh, it means everything to me. I think place is a character in my novels. And, of course, I've written novels set in New Orleans, where I grew up, and New Orleans has influenced everything I've written in a way. But I've lived in Northern California for many years, too. And I love exploring the Redwood Forest as sort of dark and spooky and a place where spirits can live and where there can be ghosts and a sense of brooding evil and menace and so forth. And I've lived in San Francisco for years, and that's where my hero, Reuben Golding, comes from. And to me, it's a lot of fun to develop place in terms of atmosphere and ambience and to develop houses. I have a big house in this novel called Nideck Point, and it's a fictional house, but it's a combination of all the big houses I've lived in the South and in California. And I had a lot of fun sort of constructing that house, just like developing a character in the book.
I have to tell you, that's one of my favorite things about reading your books is the houses that you describe, and they're often very ornate. Mm-hmm. And then when there's an event or a party, which also figures heavily
yes.
into this book.
Right.
When you entertain actual people, do you mm-hmm. sweat over it as much as you do when you're trying to entertain readers with with those settings?
Well, I've given a lot of great big parties and reunions in my time in New Orleans. I owned a big building there called St. Elizabeth's Orphanage. It was a city block. And my beloved sister-in-law, Nancy Diamond, ran that building for me. And she and I had reunions there that hosted over 1,000 people.
Wow.
You know, we would just have an endless stream of people coming through there. And we loved that. We really loved it. And one of the reasons I dedicated this novel to Nancy was because she worked so well with those big crowds and did such miracles. Hmm. For those Christmas reunions and family reunions.
So I'm always curious when I speak to an author. I mean, we think of people writing novels as sort of introverted, but you also have to connect with people on a really deep level. And do you feel like you can put yourself in one category or another, introvert or extrovert?
Well, I really spend a lot of time alone, mm-hmm. and I have to. I need to be alone to write, and I don't have any social calendar of mm-hmm. any kind. And then when I've finished a book, then I go out, and I have dinner with my friends and see my old friends and see my family and so forth. And sometimes I really see only my family. There just isn't time for anything else. But I have had a very, especially in New Orleans during those years, I had a very rich social life. And I wanted to describe in this novel how the Morphinkinder, or the werewolves, give this huge Christmas banquet and gala for the people of Northern California who don't know
right.
that they're werewolves, of course. They just think that they're human beings that own this great big wonderful house. And then after giving that great big party for the human beings, they go off in the woods and they do what they have to do as werewolves to celebrate midwinter in their traditional way. Maybe that's a metaphor for what I do as a writer. I don't know.
How much did you research sort of the old stories of werewolves? Because you've given yourself a lot of leeway here. And frankly, it makes them very interesting because your vision for these creatures becomes what we associate with them.
Mm-hmm. I did research, but I had done it before, really. You know, for years I've written about vampires and witches and ghosts and legends of all kinds pertaining to the supernatural. So there really wasn't a lot of new research to do on werewolves. What I did do was watch all the movies that had been made that I could find on werewolves. And, of course, I was very inspired by Neil Jordan's The Company of Wolves, which is one of the best. And I love the old Lon Chaney Jr.
Really?
Movies because he's so tortured and so doesn't want to be a werewolf. And he also runs around in a shirt and trousers, which I think is kind of interesting when he is a werewolf. But what I realized early on from that research was that I wanted my werewolf to be conscious. Mm-hmm. I wanted him to know what was happening to him when he went through the change, and I wanted him to be able to talk and really be himself. I didn't like the fact that almost all werewolf movies end with the person becoming a four-footed animal and losing himself entirely, and then, of course, being killed by a silver bullet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess there's less dramatic tension there because you can't really identify. You identify with the human maybe going through the transformation, but once they're there,
yes,
it's something else.
That's exactly it. So I really wanted Ruben to be able to chronicle all of it. He even photographs himself with his iPhone when he's, you know, in full wolf coat and takes pictures of himself as he's changing. And I felt somebody would do that today. I wanted this to be realistic. I thought, what would I do if this had happened to me? I've been bitten. I'm turning into this powerful creature. Well, I would photograph this. Mm-hmm. And I would put the pictures on my computer and I'd study them. There's no question. So I had him do those things. Some people have found that a little jarring, you know. But I think you can do that and also bring a gothic sensibility and a romantic sensibility to a novel. You can do it all. You can weave it all together. And that's what I'm trying to do.
So his life is complicated by the fact that he has the wolf gift, and yet he finds he rather likes it, and, mm-hmm. and he's got these enhanced senses, which at
Definitely.
First he doesn't even realize what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was thinking about your powers as an artist to really notice the details that other people overlook.
Yeah, I think I think when we're writing about supernatural characters, we're always speaking metaphorically about ourselves. You know, vampires and werewolves are metaphors for the outcast in all of us, but they're also metaphors for the artist in all of us, the sensitive one, the one who's noticing a lot of things that nobody else is noticing. And a lot of that sensitivity adds to the sense of being an outcast, being kind of alone. Am I the only one who sees life like this? You know, is there anybody out there who's really like me?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You are famously really open to meeting your fans when you go to book signing events, and you actually, my understanding is you actually listen to what they have to say about what they liked and what they didn't like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How, though, do you take that and balance what 1,000 people have told you with your vision as a writer and your desire to continue sort of keeping people in suspense?
Well, I think at times it can be difficult. I'm profoundly grateful for the feedback and for the relationship I have with my readers, especially on Facebook. We have a great Facebook page with over 900,000 people following, and they'll answer any question I throw out. Mm-hmm. They'll give me invaluable answers. But you do at times have to draw back from all the different requests and the different preferences and the different biases, and you have to remember that what they really want of you is that you write the book you believe in and that you want to write and that you want to read yourself. You know, that's what they're really asking of you. But it can be rough, you know, when they're giving you contending opinions and so forth. But basically 99% of it is positive for me. I've been very lucky in that regard.
So your sister was a novelist. Your husband was a poet and a painter. Your son is a novelist.
Right.
What is your thinking about nature or nurture when it comes to artistic talent?
Well, certainly both were at work with all of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, we come from a big Irish Catholic family in the South where storytelling was part of what we did. Everybody knew how to tell the story of his own or her own life in the interesting incidents. And you know, my son grew up hearing all those stories just as I grew up hearing them. I don't know. A lot of it's genetic, I think. A lot of it's inherited. At the same time, there have always been people in the family who were not writers, not poets, didn't have any interest in storytelling. So who can say? I really don't know. I was delighted when Christopher, my son, decided to be a novelist, mm-hmm. and delighted when he wrote this book, The Heavens Rise, because it's his first supernatural novel. And we've been touring together. We're going to sign together tonight
at
B&M. We'll both be there. Mm-hmm. And it's great fun because, again, it's a supernatural novel like mine is a supernatural novel. Christopher has written maybe 5 other novels that are not supernatural novels. But we've been having a great time together you know.
Yeah, it has to be amazing to be able to share that. I mean, he's well established now. Were mm-hmm. you always confident? Could you tell when he was very young that he was going to be good? Because that would be a heartbreak if you were to read his first novel and think, oh, no.
That would have been bad, wouldn't it? Actually, I didn't read his first novel till it was in hardcovers.
Really?
You know, yeah. I was sick at the time that he wrote it. That's mm-hmm. why he had come home and why he happened to write it. Mm-hmm. I was sick. And I was quite delighted. I thought it was wonderful. I was very impressed. And I thought he was a natural writer and natural storyteller. And frankly, I was surprised because in high school, Christopher had been an actor. Mm-hmm. And I had thought the stage was what would be in his future. And he wanted to write screenplays. So I was very surprised that suddenly I was holding this novel in my hand, A Density of Souls. It was his first novel. It was all about growing up in high school in New Orleans. And I was just knocked out. So I've always been glad that he went into the family business.
My guest is novelist Anne Rice. Her newest book is called The Wolves of Midwinter. She's in town for an appearance at 7 this evening at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. Her son Christopher Rice will be there as well. We will resume the conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Need to take just a quick break right now to remind you that we are raising money for the station in our fall membership campaign. You can do your part at 888-694-6931 or go to kera.org. And Jeff Whittington, executive producer of Think, we have copies of The Wolves of Midwinter available today as a thank you gift.
We do indeed. And I've got some really exciting news. The first 10 copies have actually already been graciously autographed by Anne Rice herself.
Oh, that's amazing.
So these are available at our regular, you know, the average gift level of about $10 a month, $120 all at once in support of KERA. And of course, you know, you've already bought the product. You've already bought the radio station. You listen to the station all the time. We are thanking you with your very own copy of Anne Rice's new book. And if you're one of the first 10 people to go online to kera.org or to call 888-694-6931 and request that thank you gift, you'll get an autographed copy.
Might well be worth an additional gift if you are already a member in good standing and up to date. You can get your copy by calling in to 888-694-6931. Better to call than to go online, or can we do either one?
It doesn't matter.
Great.
It doesn't matter.
Okay, so you can also go online to kera.org. Your support of this station allows us to bring you amazing guests like Anne Rice. Yesterday we had Jim Lehrer. Next week we'll have Elizabeth Gilbert and, of course, all the many nonfiction authors that we have on the program as well. Not every radio station would devote an hour to a conversation like this, but we are proud to be able to serve you with this because we know it's what you want. We report only to you because we are not commercially supported by advertising, but we do have to come to you and ask for your financial support.
Yeah, and as Jim Lehrer said here in this room yesterday, you know, none of us have ever had any issue with coming directly to you and asking you to help pay for the programming here, because this is what it's all about. As Chris said, we don't serve any advertisers. There's nobody calling up our editors and saying, you guys ran that story on my business. And I mean, it's just that's not how it works here. You call us up and you say, hey, I want to know more about this. And as a matter of fact, yesterday we had one of the highest traffic days ever in history on KERA's digital properties, KERANews.org, KERA.org, a couple of huge stories that were blowing up yesterday on the digital side of KERA. You know what? You help pay for that, too, when you make your contribution at 888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org.
Your gift makes you a patron of quality journalism, of programming that explores ideas.
PQJ.
And a program that explores ideas and really interesting notions and the arts and the sciences and religion and ethics and just everything under the sun. Not every radio station can provide that because they are busy serving their advertisers. We are here to serve you and ask that you make a contribution to support this programming at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Anne Rice.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with novelist Anne Rice. Her newest book is called The Wolves of Midwinter. She's in town for an appearance this evening at 7, along with her son, novelist Christopher Rice, at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So you have said that you didn't set out to be sort of a heroine to the LGBT community, but then when Interview with a Vampire came out, a lot of people instantly identified with that sense of the sort of closeted nature of vampires.
Mm-hmm.
Once you knew that, did it change the way you thought about your characters, and did it give you sort of a different avenue to explore the things that they were hiding?
No, I don't think it changed my view. I always had a strong tendency to make my characters bisexual or have them just transcend gender.
Mm-hmm.
Gender just didn't matter,
yeah.
You know, or doesn't to my characters. And I almost can't control that when I'm writing. I was very gratified that gay critics wrote such wonderful substantive reviews of Interview with the Vampire, calling it a gay allegory. But I think it would be a disaster to think too consciously about that kind of thing when you write. I really try to get into the story, get into those characters, and just I go for a feeling of authenticity with what they do. But, you know, maybe some things are bound to influence you. You don't know. That's the very idea, is to let all that swim around and brew, and you don't know. You just write, you know.
What did you learn about Jesus by writing about his life in a fictional way?
Oh, that was, for me, one of the most wonderful experiences, to write the two Christ the Lord novels about Jesus. I really wanted to see if I could take Jesus, the incarnate Word, the Son of God, and make him a living, breathing character in a novel for people, and have it be biblically correct and totally biblically correct. And it was a great challenge, you know, put the Holy Family right on the dusty roads of the Holy Land and put them right into troubled times in Jerusalem when there were riots in the temple area and just to deal with the hot, weary days in Nazareth when Jesus was a little boy and then later when he was a young man and to try to think, what was it like day to day? You know, people were whispering about him saying, well, wasn't there all that talk of angels when he was born? And what about his mother and the angel? And here he is, he's just a carpenter. Why doesn't he do something? You know, I wanted to get what that was like to live with that kind of gossip. I wanted to take the whole biblical picture seriously, not water it down in any way, and still try to write from his point of view what that was like. And it was a great thrill. I mean, I love doing those books, and they've been wonderfully received by Christians and non-Christians, and I still to this day get, you know, many letters on them every day from people who are reading them, and to me they're two of my best novels, but it's very sad that I have a lot of readers who've never read them and probably never will, because they're not about vampires, witches, and ghosts and so forth.
Do you ever look around at all the, like, sexy teenage vampires and think, oh no, look what I've unleashed?
Well, I'll leave it to others to say who unleashed all this, but I must confess, as amused as I am, I marvel at the domestication of the vampire.
Hmm.
You know, with me, my vampire heroes were sort of exotic, otherworldly, larger-than-life characters that came, you know, storming into the picture in riding boots and with, you know, with a large aura and so forth. And now we have the vampire as the boy next door, as the kid next to you in biology class.
I was just going to say, yes, sweating,
you know,
over homework. Yeah.
Right. Vampires who go to high school over and over and over again. I could hardly bear it once. You know.
That is sort of the definition of hell,
and the idea, yes, and the idea of being an immortal and hanging around in Forks, Washington is almost more than I can stake. But, you know, Stephanie Meyer has done something wonderful there. Kids love those books.
Mm-hmm.
They love Edward, you know.
Or they love Jacob.
Yes, more of Jacob or Edward, right. It, more power to her. Same with Charlene Harris. Wonderful, inventive writer. And her vampires of Bonton, Louisiana are just incredibly wonderful creations. Eric and Bill and Suki Stackhouse, the psychic. I love all of it, really. I've enjoyed it a lot.
So what do you remember about going to high school here in Richardson?
Well, actually, I loved Richardson. I had just come from New Orleans, and Richardson was sort of brand new and modern, and all the houses were new, and all of us lived pretty much in new houses, and it was a lot of fun. I made a lot of good friends in Richardson. I had a whole gang of friends, and it was a great year, my senior year there. I went on to Denton to college, to Texas Women's University, and then later to North Texas State, and I was married in Denton to Stan Rice, whom I met in journalism in Richardson High School.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Karen in Dallas. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, my name is Karen. I was Karen Fickert, and I was in the class of 1960 at Richardson High School, and my mother was the PE teacher. And I remember Anne, and I remember when she started dating Stan. And she may not remember any of that, but I'm glad to hear you say that you enjoyed your year in Richardson because even before you were famous, we enjoyed having you with us that year. And so I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you, Karen. That's very sweet, and I do remember it vividly. I remember everything about Richardson, and I just loved it. My parents lived at that time on Rory Drive, and I had some of just the best friends there. I can remember so many names, Stuart Correll and Lynn Packard and Ann Fecady and Katie Lou Franklin and just all kinds of wonderful people. I don't even want to stop because there's just so many people it was a great time, and it was a great time too, to go up to Denton and go to Texas Women's University, and a lot of us from Richardson did go up there, and we stayed friends for that first year of college. It was really wonderful.
How did you study writing? Did you decide that you had to write in order to learn to be a writer rather than sort of studying academically?
Well, I felt getting an education was indispensable. I had to get a college education. I had to read. I had to learn what the world was about. So there never was a real conflict for me, but I always felt writing was something I was going to do privately. I did ultimately take creative writing classes, but I'm not sure I learned anything specific in those classes. I could learn as much in a literature class. I learned a lot in the journalism class at Texas Women's University when the teacher would talk about writing with as few abstractions as possible and making your writing very concrete and specific, and how hard that was, how much easier it was to load it up with adverbs and adjectives. I never forgot that. I never forgot those lessons. So it was always the private writer developing, but and sort of open like a sponge to getting as much stimulation and education in the arts, in music, in literature, in politics, in history, everything. You know, that's what my education was really like.
When you are actively working on a book, do you have to be careful about what you read?
Well, I read mainly what helps me to work. Mm-hmm. You know, like you'd never be able to guess what I actually read. It's so strange. I mean, I can be writing every day and I'll be reading a Jack Reacher novel by Lee Child simply because that novel reminds me to keep pushing that story forward. You know, it's very different from what I do, the Jack Reacher novels. They're just pure thrillers. Mm-hmm. And yet that's exactly what I need to go in there with fresh ideas every day. I need something different from me that's not going to contaminate me in any way, but something that's going to show me how to drive the plot. I read Jackie Suzanne last time around. Again, I read Valley of the Dolls just to remind myself of that raw power that Jackie had to tell a great story, no matter how crude it was or how vulgar.
But everybody can't put it down. So.
Yeah. I read Peyton Place again last year, this year, as a matter of fact. And I read a great novel by Henry Bellarmine called King's Row. It was sort of the Peyton Place of its time. It was a big 1940 bestseller. And again, I was looking for that raw storytelling power because I do get kind of lost in the introspection of my characters. And I have to remind myself, tell the story, move it on, you know, get going. So I will just ruthlessly pick up anything that'll feed the energy when I'm writing.
How do you know when a series is done, when
oh,
you're
gosh.
Finished with it?
They're never done. You could always go back and resume, you know. It's never really done. I think what happens is you finish for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, I could go back to books I wrote like The Mummy and Servant of the Bones, a thriller about a ghost, and I could make them into series probably if I had enough time. You know, you end up choosing to do certain things only because you give up doing other things.
Yeah, that's got to be a hard choice sometimes.
Yeah, it is.
And so when you have ideas, if you're working on one project but something occurs to you, do you write it down in a notebook? Do you just remember? What's your system for organizing?
Actually, I email it to myself.
Really?
I write an email to myself on the idea. I put the subject line, idea, novel, you know, or whatever. And then I save that in a Gmail file, new ideas, novels, whatever. And I have it right there floating in Gmail for eternity, presumably.
Speaking of that, you are very active. You alluded to your Facebook page.
Yeah.
You've got a huge Twitter presence.
Right.
Did you wholeheartedly embrace those technologies when they came along? Did you sort of wait to see what they would be like and how they might feed you?
I was introduced to them. Mm-hmm. I think it was my publisher's idea, get a Facebook page. So I thought, okay, let's get a Facebook page. And I began to post myself and began to read the page every day, and I loved it. And I got more and more involved with the page. In the beginning, I posted only pleasant things. Mm-hmm. There was never anything negative. Then I began to get interested in politics, I was always interested in politics. I began to express my interest in politics, and I began to interact with the people on the page about a whole spectrum of subjects, and they began to bring stories to me, and we would get in arguments, we would have discussions, and we're still doing it. And for me, it's been absolutely wonderful. I guess I can ask them any question, and they'll give me the answer. I can say, those of you who like the witch novels, tell me which character you like the best. Which one did you find the most sympathetic? And I'll just get 1,000 answers within an hour or two, and they'll just be wonderful answers.
Do you fight the temptation the rest of us do when you need to be working to go and check your Facebook page?
Well, that's you've got to modulate that. Mm-hmm. You've got to modulate that. And, of course, that temptation's always there. You know, before I start, maybe I should check Facebook one more time. Just one more time, you know.
My guest is novelist Anne Rice. Her newest book is called The Wolves of Midwinter. She's in town for an appearance this evening at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. Her son will be there as well, novelist Christopher Rice. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We're going to break here for just a few minutes. Jeff Whittington, who is executive producer of Think, has just joined me in studio. Hello again, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We are working on a goal today, actually, of $35,000 for the fall fundraising campaign. And Chris, we've made some great progress today. We've raised nearly $25,000 today already, thanks to so many of you who have called 888-694-6931 or have joined online at kera.org. $10,376 left to go by 7 o'clock, and that's important because there's a challenge in play, and I'll get some details on that for you. But we're trying to make this goal, to make this drive as short as possible. And we have an incentive today during this great conversation with Anne Rice. We have copies of Anne's new book.
That's right. It is available as a thank you gift with a contribution of $120 or more. I'm not sure. We don't have an update on how many copies are gone, but
we have six left.
Six left.
Yep.
Okay. So we have six copies that are signed by Anne Rice, which was such a nice thing of her to do. So if you would like a copy, original copy signed, this is really amazing. Make your gift now. If you are already a member, maybe you want to make an additional gift for this one. And please, if you were inclined to make a larger contribution, don't let us stop you. That $120 is sort of the minimum suggested level for this thank you gift. But if you want to do $20 a month or $30 or $50, we can certainly make that happen and make this your thank you gift.
Yeah, $120 is $10 a month. It's really, you know, it's like 30-something cents a day in support of your public radio station. You know, I used to joke that, you wear more than 33 cents worth of sole off the bottom of your shoes every day. And then didn't somebody tell me to stop saying that?
No, but I thought you were going to say you wear that much cologne. And I was going to say, no, no, I don't.
and we've also stopped urging you to forego your daily fancy coffee.
Because, for crying out loud, have your Starbucks.
Yeah, have your fancy coffee and support public radio. And we'd love to thank you with the copy of Anne Rice's book. And again, we have six copies left that are autographed. Now, after those six are gone, of course, we'll still have copies of the book available.
Mm-hmm.
But Anne graciously and generously offered to sign 10 copies of the book for us today. And we're really excited to offer it to you when you call 888-694-6931 or contribute at KERA.org. And Chris, we're moving the needle just a little bit on the goal for the day, $10,253 left to raise.
Your contribution right now can take us that much closer to our goal for the day and for the overall drive. You know that KERA is a not-for-profit organization, and some of us sort of, you know, we draw ourselves tighter when anybody knocks at the door and asks for money or any cause comes along. The difference here is that we are a not-for-profit organization that serves you directly. There's nothing wrong with a lot of the other organizations that are raising money all the time, but that you may or may not have any direct connection to them. You do have a direct, really important, fundamental connection to KERA. We hear from a lot of you who feel like, you know, certain parts of your day without KERA just don't feel right. It's like you have one eye closed. We want to be there for you. We want to stay strong. We want to expand the things we're able to offer you. Your contributions make it possible for us to do this at 888-694-6931 and also at KERA.org.
And you're hearing it. You're hearing it every single day from our growing news team. You know, our great reporting team includes Jerome Weeks, Lauren Silverman, Stella Chavez, who's our new education reporter. Lauren's our new health and science reporter, and although she's been here nearly a year. Of course, we got Bill Zeeble, we got BJ Austin, we got Shelley Koffler. You hear Sam Baker in the morning, Justin Martin in the afternoon. And we've just added, and if you're listening last hour, we've just added a new digital editor, Eric Austin, who is burning up the GigaWeb with lots of stories that you are seeing online at keranews.org. You're seeing them on Facebook. You're seeing them on Twitter. And many of you are following KERA News on Facebook and Twitter. And that's great because it just provides yet another way for you to interact with and get the information that you need from KERA. And we're all about meeting those needs. It's just a couple of times a year we ask you to help pay the cost associated with all of these initiatives we've got going on that are all in service of you. So do your part right now. Call 888-694-6931 or click and contribute at kera.org. And Chris, we just got an update. We've got 5 signed copies of Anne Rice's new novel left. Only 5 left.
And I would imagine there's folks getting online right now. So if you want this, this is something that you need to act on. Oh, now we're down at 4. So you need to act on this quickly. These are not going to be around for much longer. 888-694-6931 or kera.org. This is your chance. This is also your chance to support the fact that we are the station that brings you in-depth interviews with people like Anne Rice. Your contribution does keep the station strong. It brings you this kind of content day in and day out throughout the year. Please go online now to kera.org or make your contribution over the phone at 888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with novelist Anne Rice. Her newest book is called The Wolves of Midwinter. It's the second in the Wolf Gift series. She's in town for an appearance this evening at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You have been so open about explorations of your faith in a way that many people are not willing to do. You were raised in the Catholic Church, became an atheist when you were a teenager, went back to the church, and then finally left not Christ but Christianity as an organized belief system. When you look back on your past, do you feel like you were mistaken in those other times? Were they just necessary steps on the journey to where you are now?
I would say steps on the journey to where I am now. I can't see any point in regretting a sincere move, mm-hmm. one way or the other. I'm glad it all happened. I'm glad I went through it all. I'm glad especially that I had 12 years there to study the Bible and to pray and to be part of the church again and to really study theology and study scripture before moving away again from organized religion and deciding that faith in Christ was something much bigger than denominations and churches and sects and theologies and theologians.
Did you lose friends at any point along the journey, people who had thought that they related to you because you had similar views?
I did, but I'm not close friends. No, I really didn't. In fact, I found many of my Catholic friends when I left again, they were pretty generous about it. Mm-hmm. You know, they were as loyal as ever. You know, they thought I was mistaken to mm-hmm. leave organized religion. But no, I didn't really lose any close friends. I did lose a lot of readers here and there.
Really?
Many readers felt when I went back to Christ and went back to being a Catholic that I had betrayed them. Hmm. They had loved the vampire novels, and they had loved the secular humanism and the atheistic philosophy in those novels. And they really felt betrayed, and still do to some extent. And they weren't happy about it. And you'll see their reviews pop up on Amazon sometimes. They're very negative about Christianity. And they haven't changed their mind, even though I've since left organized religion. The fact that I believe still offends them, you know. But that, what am I going to do? There's nothing to be done about that. I mean, I embrace all my novels and always have. I've never repudiated any of it. And, you know, and I hope my novels will transcend who I am and stand on their own 2 feet, whatever. You know?
It is interesting that people in America today seem to have this need to sort of know where others in their lives are and then either affiliate with people or not affiliate with people based on differences or similarities.
That's true. And it seems that the Internet is helping that, that people go out and look for confirmation of what they already believe and look for people who believe like they believe. And it's a shame in a way that that dominates so much because the Internet is such a great way to learn all about people who don't believe what you believe and who can teach you all about new experiences.
So much of your work has really dealt with this kind of universal discomfort we have with death. We're all a little bit afraid of it, and yet we all maybe hope, including I would think some people who don't believe in any kind of afterlife still like the idea that it would be possible if it
mm-hmm.
were possible.
Sure.
Do you think this is something that we just need to explore, whether it's through religion or through fiction or through a combination of the two? Is it something that sort of every life that contains deep thought has to touch on?
Seems to me that that's the case, yes. I mean, I remember as a little girl being very worried about it when I was 5 years old, you know. And I've never lived without a certain amount of cosmic uncertainty. No matter what I believe, there's always a fear that there'll be nothing mm-hmm. after death, that there is no real meaning to this world except the meaning we give it. And I never shake that fear. And sometimes I think we're meant maybe to live with that kind of cosmic uncertainty. I don't know. I always marvel when I meet someone who tells me that they have actually met Jesus, or they have met an angel, or they've met a ghost, or they've had a near-death experience. I envy that person the confirmation that they received through that supernatural experience. But I've never had anything like that happen to me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to David calling from California. Hi, David.
Hey, greetings. Yeah, I wanted to ask about her first book, the first main one, The Interview with a Vampire. But just in that last little conversation you were having, I can tell you that you have met now. I am the son of Santa Claus. My dad was Santa Claus for many years in St. Louis, so I'm the son of Santa. And,
right.
You know, I was very struck by your first book, the Interview with a Vampire, in that there were a lot of different, I'll say, analogies that people could take from vampirism. For example, economic vampires or vampires of love or social vampires. And I'm just wondering if you got kind of typecast when you originally wrote that book, did you intend to have a whole bunch of different analogies for the types of vampirism that goes on in society? But then you got sort of typecast with your later books, and you had to actually stick with a bloodsucker as opposed to an economic or a vampire of love?
Well, I don't think that I got typecast, really. I think that what you're talking about is the metaphor of the vampire is so rich. It has to do with all these different aspects. People do say they meet psychic vampires who drain their energy, and people accuse other people of being vampires when they rip them off in various ways or drain them of wealth, as you said, economic vampires. I think it's all built into the idea of the vampire. What I set out to do was to write novels in which the vampires were absolutely real, and usually the only characters in the book were vampires. And I didn't worry about anything else. I didn't worry about all those meanings. I knew all those meanings were going to take care of themselves in the text.
It must be fascinating to you. It's remarkable that, you know, that book was published in 76. 76.
Mm-hmm.
People are still talking about it as if it's brand new.
Right.
I started reading your books when I was a teenager. Now I have teenagers who think they have discovered you on their own and that they are the first generation to sort of embrace this. And I wonder what that feels like. This may be for you something that happened a very long time ago, but it is brand new for a lot of people that you encounter.
Well, it's an answer to a prayer. Hmm. I mean, I think when I was a young writer, what I feared more than anything else was indifference and people just forgetting what I wrote, that it wouldn't mean anything, that it would have a shelf life of 9 days, as they used to say back then about a paperback. And I'm just profoundly grateful my books are still out there, that they're still alive, that people can find them. I'm thrilled. I'm totally. That's one of the most satisfying things about my life, I think, is that those novels have hung on and that they continue to have meaning for people. Sometimes I go on Amazon and just look at the current reviews of Interview with the Vampire, or I look at the reviews of the movie with Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt. And I'm so thrilled every time I see somebody say, I just discovered this movie, and it's really incredible, or I just discovered this novel, and it's, you know, what can I say? I'm overwhelmed. It's what I dreamed of, you know.
It strikes me that maybe you're a glutton for punishment, because you can go on Amazon and find people that love your work, and then you can find people who are very rude and sort of write these troll things.
Yeah.
Do you? Does the last one you read sort of affect the course of the next 15 minutes of your life?
It can. It can. I've tried to get used to the fact that my books are controversial. You know, people just aren't indifferent to them. Almost every book I've written, somebody has gone on Amazon and said, this is the worst book ever published. This woman can't write. She should stop. You know, this, and I kind of have to face it that's happening, but that other people are saying just the opposite, that they find it to be a wonderful book and so forth. And again, most of my experience is positive, but I don't know quite what to think about the huge divide there. You know, it's the same with The Wolf Gift and with The Wolves of Midwinter. There are people just saying, this is so awful. Don't spend a nickel on it, you know. And then there are other people saying it's just wonderful and so forth. I don't really quite understand it, but I accept it. And I think it's a lot better than indifference.
Did you ever have fears that there would come a time in your life when you would think, I got to hang it up, I'm out of ideas? Because it seems like you remain incredibly prolific and there's no signs of you slowing down whatsoever.
No, my mind is so filled with ideas. Right now, there's so many things I want to write. Mm-hmm. I have a whole idea for a ghost story that I want to do for television. I just can't get to it. For 2 years, I've been trying to just do that or write a short story or a novel with this idea about this ghost in the Old West, no less. And I just can't get to it. I think with me, it's more a matter of hoping that I'll have the physical stamina to keep writing. Writing takes some physical stamina.
Yeah.
You know, to sit there and pound the keyboard till your shoulders are aching and your back is aching, you got to have some energy for that. And I fear I'll give out physically before my mind will give out. I'll probably be someday lying there on my deathbed thinking, wow, a wonderful story I could write right now about this subject or that nurse or what she's like, you know, whatever.
What's the difference between a good day of writing and a bad day of writing for you?
Oh, turning out some good pages. Yeah, turning out some pages that work, feeling it roll. When that's happening, that's the greatest. And I knock off about 8 o'clock and I just feel wonderful, you know. And I fall into my recliner with a bag of potato chips and a Diet Coke. And after taking enough insulin, I'm diabetic. And I turn on Person of Interest on CBS or something and just float away, you know. That's a good day. When it's rolling and it works. A bad day is when nothing worked and the pages all got discarded.
Well, Anne Rice, it's been such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for making time.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure to be here.
The The new novel by Anne Rice is called The Wolves of Midwinter. It's the second part in the Wolf Gift series. Anne Rice is in town, along with her son, novelist Christopher Rice, for an appearance this evening at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. We want to thank all of you who have listened this hour. We greatly appreciate your participation in the show. We are proud to be able to bring you a guest like Anne Rice. We're able to do that thanks to your contributions at 888-694-6931 and online at kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back with us now. Jeff, what a delight Anne Rice was to speak with.
Wow. I mean, I need to call my mom, you know. No, seriously, I read those books when I was, I think, in high school.
Yeah.
The interview with the vampire books, and it just, you know, it's such a pop culture moment, mm-hmm. in you know, American literature, I think. And what an honor to have her here. We do still have copies of Anne Rice's book, The Wolves of Midwinter, available with a contribution of $120. These sadly are not signed. We had the signed
those
ones
are
earlier.
Gone. I'm
They're
not surprised.
Gone. And thanks to everybody who called in on those. And we're making great progress on our goal. Chris, you know, our goal today is $35,000. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge. There's a challenge in play to raise $35,000 by 7 p.m. this evening. And if KERA does that, we have the opportunity to receive an additional $3,500 from Ann McGee Cooper and Associates and two other very generous supporters of the station. They're going to pool their money together and give the station an additional $3,500 only if we make that goal. So we're making great progress, though.
888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You can also go to kera.org. We do, as you know, a lot of author interviews on this show. It is not strictly a book show. Some people think you can't get on Think unless you've written a book. That's certainly not the case. But it does give us great fodder for discussion. We talk to mostly nonfiction authors, occasionally a novelist here and there, which is always a pleasure for me to get to read a novel for work, as you might imagine. But we know so many of you base your reading lists on what you hear about on this show. We are thrilled to be able to provide that service to you. Think about, you know, when you buy a new hardcover book, it's between $25 and $35 often. If you would commit that much a month to KERA, you would be doing a great service to the station, and you hear every single day how that money gets spent. You already believe in the product. You are a habitual user, and we know KERA is a big part of your life. Just make it a little part of your philanthropic life and see how great that feels.
Even if you are a Kindle or other digital e-reader,
$9.99.
Yeah, and that $10 that you spend on a novel or a nonfiction book, I think about, you know, making that contribution to KERA every month, and that's the $120 level, which is right in line with what most people give. On average, the average gift to KERA is about $120. Some people join for $35. Some people join at the $1,500 friends level, which is always available. Some people this year are joining at the Jim Lehrer Roundtable level, which is a $10,000 annual gift, and that's fantastic. Believe me, we'll take any contribution, no matter what size it is, no matter what level it is. There are a number of ways to pay. It's because we want to get this membership campaign successfully concluded and get right back to doing what you've come to love and depend upon KERA to do, to bring you news and information you don't find anywhere else.
Do us this favor, if you would, as well. If you are already a member, maybe you've been a sustaining member for years, maybe you have just made your contribution or you did it last spring or whatever, let your friends know, let your neighbors know that you're a KERA member. Maybe send out a tweet, maybe go on Facebook. I think there are a lot of people out there who just assume they don't know anybody who gives to KERA and that it's something that other people do, meaning not them. You might be surprised by the response from people in your life if you let them know that this is something that matters to you.
Yeah, when you're at a cocktail party or a happy hour, everybody listens. You know, everybody says, "Oh, I heard that story. Wow, did you hear Radiolab? Wow, yeah, I heard. Oh, The Moth. I've been listening to The Moth on Saturday nights." Mm-hmm. And it's so, you know, everybody seems to listen. But then when you say, "Oh, great, are you a supporter?"
Many,
you
know, people, like, some people say yes. We meet, and we're thrilled to thank people who say I'm a supporter.
Absolutely, and you know, and sometimes people say, "Oh, yeah, I gave." Well, maybe you gave and maybe it's been a couple of years. You know, check out that member card, see if it's expired. If it is, we'd love to hear from you today. 7,800 and change left to raise by 7 o'clock today to meet our $35,000 challenge from Ann McGee Cooper and Associates and a couple of other very generous supporters of the station. They're going to give the station an additional $3,500 if we make that goal, and we can do it with your call to 888-694-6931.
You can also go online to kera.org. Check out thank you gifts there, including copies of Anne Rice's new book, The Wolves of Midwinter. This is the second in a series. The first one was called The Wolf Gift. The series is called The Wolf Gift Chronicles. Maybe you've read the first, maybe you haven't, but it would be wonderful to have this, add it to your library and have it waiting for you when you get through the first one.
I love that she's not, well, I'm not sure if she watched the Twilight films
or
watches the True
familiar.
Blood series, but I know she's read the material.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty great to think that Anne Rice is maybe, you know, can't wait for the next season of True Blood to get to come out. It's so awesome to think about.
I think it would be really daunting for Stephanie Meyer and company to know that the great Anne Rice is reading the new versions.
Maybe we should
pull
out those endorsements and send them along.
Send them along. 1-888-694-6931 is the number to give, or go online to kera.org. Your contribution does make a difference to the station. It makes a difference to the entire community because, of course, you're giving to KERA not only to give back all this material to you that you love to listen to every day, but to make it available to everyone in the North Texas listening area and anyone online who has access to the internet. So we really appreciate it. 888-694-6931 or kera.org.